some thoughts and perspectives upon what's happening in our country, in Eretz Yisrael, the last couple of days since Yom Yerushalayim, since Monday, the escalating war in the south, the barrage of rockets, the civil unrest within our country, and of course the loud fusillade of anti-Israel sentiment across the cybersphere. So there's a story that I heard on the news the other night, which sticks out, which was a eureka moment for me. Not a eureka, but just it's a very resonant moment. It was 2 nights ago. I'm recording this on Thursday, so it was Tuesday night. I was up late watching the news, following some of the rioting, the pogroms in Lod. Lod is a city in the center of the country, close to a little bit south of the country, but south-central of the country, as a mixed population, and a lot of Arab youth were rioting, burning shuls, throwing Molotov cocktails, burning cars, lynching people. And I'll get to, obviously, we've had a lot of unrest on both sides of the ledger. And a young woman who had been caught, I think, even in Yerushalayim or Tel Aviv, told by her, who lived in Lod, told by her family not to return to Lod, which is too dangerous, was being interviewed on the news. She was describing the wonderful cordial relations that she had with her neighbors throughout all these years. And Lod is known, as many towns in Israel are, for peaceful cooperation, cross-religious relationships, Arabs and Jews. And she said these are people that she's lived next to. When I say next to, I mean literally. Some people that don't live in Israel can't imagine what next to means. Literally in the same apartment building, literally side by side, literally door to door. And they had invited each other over for their various Yom Tovim and for their Simchas and given Mazel Tov and people that had lived hand in hand, side by side. And she said, the last 2 days, I looked in their eyes and their eyes were somewhere else. The look was very different. I saw anger. I saw violence. I saw rage. And of course, that violence and rage erupted, maybe not in the neighbors per se, but and many of the people who were rioting in Lod in other Israeli towns. Now, when I heard that story, I said, wait a second. To myself, I said, wait a second. I've heard this story before. My grandmother told me this story. My grandmother lived in Germany pre-war, very wealthy, upscale family, and had cordial relations with their neighbors. Same story. And my grandmother told me that what forced her to leave one day, as they were walking home, I think from the grocery, they passed by one of their neighbors in Germany. And the neighbor was holding a basket, and the neighbor, the non-Jewish neighbor, made some symbolic gesture that he would cut off her head and put it in the basket, maybe the choke sign or something, the equivalent. At that point, someone in my grandmother's family knew it was time to leave. And that story happened before. And you know what? It didn't just happen in Lod 2-3 nights ago, and it didn't just happen in Germany 85 years ago. It happened throughout Arabic lands. I'm sure this story has been told thousands of times throughout the thousands of years that we were in exile. Friendly neighbors, cordial, great, peaceful cooperation, love each other, share family, share finances, loan each other's money, support each other in times of crisis. And then something shifts. Something changes. And those eyes become violent and those neighbors become hostile and it all goes sideways. And it's important that I connected that story to my grandmother's story and to all the stories, whether it was in Tunisia or Syria or Egypt or France or Spain or Poland or Hungary or wherever. Because there is a tendency in today's world that when we face Hamas or we face Iranian hostility or we face anti-Semitism or we face, there is a tendency to modernize and localize the experience for three reasons. But when we modernize and localize the experience, we sever it from history. It's no longer part of Tunisia, Syria, Spain, Poland, France, Russia, Germany. It's something different. And let's process it with different terms and on different conditions. Why do we disconnect it? Well, First of all, because it takes a different language in every generation. It's hard to connect any generation to the past generation because anti-Semitism is just, it's like a virus, as Rabbi Sacks would always say. It takes on the DNA of its host. It takes different forms, and it's never the same. Sometimes it's racist, and sometimes it's social Darwinism, and sometimes it's monotheistic, and sometimes we kill Jesus, and sometimes it's because of conspiracy. And you could be a Jew living on the German-Russian front in the latter stages of World War II, and every day the boundary changes, and one day you're being accused by the Russians, by the Soviet Communist Russians, of being part of the global conspiracy of capitalism. And then the next day, the Germans conquer the village, and you're accused of being part of the communist bloc. And it's different narratives, even back to back, day to day, within 24 hours. So it's difficult to connect anti-Semitism throughout any generation. It always takes a new language, new terminology, new incarnations. But there are two particular conditions in the modern world which makes it more difficult for people to connect the dots. Number one, we believe, and it is true in many, many areas, in almost every area, that we live in a modern, enlightened world with progress in science, progress in economy, progress in technology, progress in politics, and progress in the way we treat one another, social justice and social equality, and we have welfare mechanisms in place to avoid the type of suffering and poverty and hunger that afflicted past generations. And not only is man modern and enlightened, but he's also traumatized by the racism, by the fascism, by the abuse, by the violence of the 20th century, of Hitler and of Stalin and of fascism and of Soviet communism. So we would like to believe that man has advanced beyond hatred and beyond the oldest hatred in human history. And we'd like to believe that with education and with proper democratic measures instituted and with proper policing and with enlightened leadership, we can just walk away from the hatred of anti-Semitism, because modern man is beyond that. And the third reason that people sever it is because we're living in the state of Israel. It has a different feel. It was easier to connect pogroms in Syria to pogroms in France 400 years earlier, or to pogroms in Spain, or to pogroms in... because Jews lived in similar hierarchies. Guests, visitors, without a police force to protect them, defenseless, vulnerable. Now we have a state of Israel. And we have an army. Thank God. We have a police force. And the terms are so different. And all these three factors lead people to say, well, this is all a different story. This is geopolitical. This is a story about occupation. This is a story about land. This is a story about nationalism, about imperialism, colonialism. It's the same story. It's part of the long process from which we're climbing out of Jews wandering odyssey through this world, being hated because we represent Hashem. And there are so many indicators, signals that force us to connect. It's so obvious. The juxtaposition to Yerushalayim, the fact that this all flared in and around Yerushalayim, around the time of Yerushalayim, around the time of celebrating the great miracles of 1967, around the time of Matan Torah. Why do you think Shavuos, why do you think Sivan has been a magnet for such anti-Semitism? Why do you think Chaf Sivan in Ashkenazi countries became a day of fasting and a day of Slichos because of all the pogroms? Why do you think the period between Pesach and Shavuos was the period of the Crusades and the onslaught and became, of course, enshrined and commemorated through Sfiras HaOmer? Because when we receive the Torah, when we leave Mitzrayim, Shem Wamim Yergazon, the Jews are on the march, we're Hashem's chosen people, Jewish spirit, Jewish identity has been revived, we're about to receive the Torah, and the true source of anti-Semitism, as Chazal tell us, is the delivery of Torah at Har Sinai. So the timing, Yerushalayim was the matchstick. We're a couple days from Shavuos. This is clearly a battle about religion. They torched a Beis HaKnesses, or several in Lod the other night. I thought about Rabbi Hananya ben Trajon, who was one of the 10 martyrs, who was wrapped in a Sefer Torah with wet sponges placed on his body to prevent him from dying too quickly to ensure a painful death. And when they burnt the Sefer Torah, he told his daughter, because his daughter was talking to him, he said, "Whoever will avenge the Sefer Torah will avenge my death." And once you drag religion into it, once you drag the Torah into it, then the conclusion of this battle is obvious and is already achieved. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, once the Torah is being assaulted, and once we're alongside, or we're being attacked alongside of a Sefer Torah, the conclusion how this is all going to land is pretty obvious. But this is a religious battle. It's not a political, geographical, military, another connector. I said before, that story hit me so hard. This combination between the external threats and our internal neighbors turning on us. And you can go back to Germany, and you go back to Jews in Arabic lands, you go back to Jews in European lands, you can even go back to Yeshaya, to Yirmiah, to Echa, and hear in the tone about our friends who turned out to be opponents and our allies who turned their backs on us. And we're facing literally two fronts. We're facing this homicidal, maniacal, murderous state in Gaza, shooting missiles, without any care for human bloodshed, celebrating human bloodshed. These were the same people who celebrated the Meron tragedy, which is completely innocent blood. They're not even settlers who in the mind of Hamas can be, at least in their mind, criminalized. They're just average people just gathering and assembling in a religious site. And alongside that, we're facing an internal struggle. An internal struggle about the fabric of our Jewish nation, about the relations between Arab and Jew and Israel. And that story hit me so hard. So my message is to connect what is happening in Israel to what has happened to our people throughout the last 2,000 years, not to disconnect them, not to sever them, not to compartmentalize them, to be able to see this as part of the Jewish story, part of the Jewish arc. And I'd like to provide four or five consequences or ramifications of this connecting, and then a story just to remind you how to connect it. Here is what you should not conclude because it's connected. Here are the two issues amongst many to avoid. First of all, overwhelmingly, most of the Arab citizens in the state of Israel are law-abiding, upstanding, upscale citizens who are contributing to a state in a way that is difficult for them. Understanding their position. They are doctors, lawyers, family members, homeowners, professionals, policemen, soldiers in certain areas of our army that we rely on and that we live with. And what you're seeing is a fringe element, primarily younger Arabs who are rioting. But fringe doesn't mean it's two or three. Fringe is there are groups of the Arab population seething with hostility, violent towards the Jews. And their hatred to us is fanned by centuries of Islamic hatred towards Jews, by a Quran that speaks of Jews as second-class citizens and their inability to escape that discriminatory stance. But do not fall, God forbid, into a position, God forbid, of racism. God forbid, into a position of hostility towards Arabs, and some of the scenes we're seeing, I strongly, strongly dislike the moral equivalency. They're extremists on this side, they're extremists on this side. It's not true at any level, and every time I hear it on the news, it makes me sick to my stomach. There are extremists in Israel, and those extremists have to be dealt with and apprehended, and their activities have to be monitored and policed, and it's ugly. It's ugly and it's embarrassing and it's shameful that people in our midst, and specifically people in the religious community, and specifically people in the national religious community, are part of this process. And we have to perform a serious soul-searching. How did we come here? How did we, our community, produce kippah-wearing Jews who are on the streets of Akko, on the streets of Haifa, lynching Arabs? But it's very different. There are Arab clerks and imams that are riling up and fomenting the same way that priests would foment anti-Semitism in churches across Europe throughout Christmases and Easters. And there's a seething hatred and violence that the Arabs, those Arabs that are involved in this, are instigating. But God forbid that we should generalize it. It's a fringe part of the Arab society. It's reflective of certain feelings and sentiments, but do not, God forbid, fall into racism or chas v'shalom, celebrate, support, or in any way condone the violence that is taking place. So first of all, when I talk about anti-Semitism being baked into history, it doesn't, that shouldn't serve as a green light for racist tendencies and for disrespect to people. As I always say, they're not our opponents, they're our ultimate audiences. They are the people that we will one day redeem. They are the people that one day will gather in Yerushalayim alongside of the Jewish people and see HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If they hate us, it's because they're prey to forces larger than themselves and they're unable to escape the long litany of anti-Semitism. But you can't turn into a racist or misanthrope. Number two, the fact that anti-Semitism is baked into history and this is part of that long narrative should not render us fatalistic. We shouldn't fall into fatalism as if nothing can change. We live in a far better world, and the reason that the world is better for Jews is not just the state of Israel, because of all the efforts we've taken and continue to take to battle anti-Semitism. Organizationally, through the media, at the local level, through education. So just because we feel that it's baked into history does not, and just because I feel with every shred of who I am, and just as Chazal told the Halacha Esav son of Yaakov, that it will end. When history ends, it's not an all or nothing. It's not an end game proposition. It doesn't, it's not either it exists or it doesn't exist. It could be curtailed. It could be limited. It could be softened. And every effort we take at battling anti-Semitism is worthwhile. However, connecting these events to history allows us to feel four important feelings. Number one, patience. Patience. We spent thousands of years on this battlefield. We can spend a little bit longer. We hope we don't have to. But sometimes the state of Israel creates accelerated, inappropriate, disproportionate expectations. We get all muddied and confused, frustrated when those expectations are dashed. This is the historical struggle. This is the mission HaKadosh Baruch Hu endowed Avraham with. Ki ger yezer acha be'eretz lo lahem. The battle continues. Number one, part of patience is also perspective, as I said before. What would your grandparents or your great-great-grandparents give to be in our position, facing anti-Semitism in the state of Israel within our MENA police force, facing anti-Semitism in democratic countries around the world with a police force and governments that care for Jews as best they can, facing anti-Semitism in a world in which many, many, not all, but many, many educated, morally sensitive people are not anti-Semitic. What would they give to be in our world? So it's patience and perspective. Number two, confidence. We know how this ends. We know exactly how this ends. There's no uncertainty here. There are no question marks about how this all ends. This is baked into the battle of history. We know exactly how history ends. We know exactly what happens to the Jewish people. We know exactly what happens to the nations of the world. We know exactly what happens to the wicked nations of the world. We know exactly where we'll end, how we'll end. We don't know when it will end. We don't know who will be responsible for it ending. But confidence. Confidence. Sky isn't falling. And if it is, we know it will be rebuilt. We know how it ends. It's part of a larger narrative whose conclusion, whose final chapters we've read already. Read Yeshaya. Read Zechariah. And you know how this will end. Number three, block it all out. You have to know when to turn your social media off. I know that you think you'll convince the world and you'll tweet the tweet that will go viral and will convince all. Very few people are changing sides in this battle. And it'll just lead to heartache. It'll just lead to frustration. Positions are hardened. There's arteriosclerosis. Everything is already ossified. Everyone knows there's a hatred here that's irrational. And lo sasirach rei levavchem b'chrei nechem. You have to know when to shut your eyes, when to turn away. It'll just cause such anger or such frustration. Just walk away from it. I know it's addictive. I know reading what people say. And I know it's harder in Chutz Laaretz. It's easier in Israel to create an echo chamber. But sometimes you actually need an echo chamber. I think in general it's important to be exposed to different views, and it's important to hear what other people have to say about. But now there's so much hatred, so much disproportionate, violent, and virulent positions about who we are. The moral equation is so imbalanced. We are trying to protect, as I saw someone tweeted the other day. I'm guilty sometimes of looking at my Twitter feed and following the politics. Someone tried to reduce this very simply. He said, it's very easy to understand the moral calculus of this situation. If Hamas stopped shooting rockets, the war would end. If Israel stopped protecting itself, there'd be a slaughter, mass slaughter. It's pretty obvious. One side wants to slaughter, one side wants to defend. But anger and hatred cloud people's better judgment. Just disregard. You'll be healthier for it. It's so much harder in Chutz Lartz because you're bombarded with it through the media, through the news. It's easier in Israel. And then finally, of course, faith. You can't battle this battle, and everyone's standing along this battle. Everyone's participating in the battle emotionally, existentially, protesting, supporting Israel. You have to dig deep into your historical consciousness and come up with the faith in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in our mission. There has to be a faith-based response to these events. It can't just be logistical, practical, protest, political. This is a battle of faith, a battle of religion, a battle of history. If you face it purely logistically, you'll be frustrated by it. You will not be victorious. And you need to tackle it from a perspective of faith. So here's the second story. The most nefarious of all the bombings was the Sabara bombing. I had an acquaintance whose daughter, teenage daughter, was caught in that bombing. I'm sure you've heard the story from me if you've heard some of my lectures before. I apologize if you have, but if you haven't, it's important. She, thank God, survived. She was in the hospital Friday night with her father reviewing the parsha. 14-year-old girl, 15-year-old girl. She kept asking, Abba, what happened to that Dutch family? There was a family of immigrants from Holland. Mother, father, and 3 to 5 little children were killed in a bang, in a flash. I go to their grave every year, Erev Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, say some Tehillim, ask for them to be Melitza Yosher and Shemayim. Never met them. What happened to that family? The father didn't want to share extra pain with his daughter, but finally she was so relentless. What do you need to know? He asked her. She said, Abba, I was lying in the pizza shop dazed and bruised, and I saw a little boy next to me bleeding to death, and I heard him ask his father, Abba, please help me. I'm dying. And his father said, my son, I can't help you. I'm in flames, but please reach your hand out as far as you can. Clutch my hand and let's say Shema together as we go to Shemayim. That's the story. That's the story I want to think about when I say Shema Yisrael on Rosh Hashanah and Musaf. That's why I go to the grave. One of the reasons I go. But this person, father, wrote the following afterward reflections to his email that he sent out. At that point, let's say he was in his mid-50s, probably early 50s. He said, my father stood on the train tracks in Auschwitz listening to Jews saying Shema on the way to their death. My daughter lay in the streets of Yerushalayim in a pizza shop listening to Jews say Shema on the way to their death. Why didn't my generation hear it? My generation meaning the years between 1960, 1950, and 2000, 2000 were pocket of history, padded pocket of history. We thought history, that struggle, the anti-Semitism, the struggle, it ended. We had our state, we were victorious, the old city, the biblical corridor, burgeoning triumphs. Every decade brought more triumphs. Jews were accepted and embraced across the world, offered positions of comfort and influence and affluence. And it's a modern world, that anti-Semitism, the battlefield of history, the mission of the Jews, that's passé. That's outdated. That scene that is emblazoned onto our consciousness of Jews saying Shema on the way to their death, not going to happen again. That's what many people, this person's age, my age, that's the world I grew up in. I didn't grow up in a world of battles and Shema Yisrael and martyrdom. And then the century turned, and we realize this battle is ongoing. And in Israel, we realize it through several waves of intifada. And in America, people realize it through 9/11 and other manners and forms. And connect. It's the same story. It's the same Shema Yisrael. Those are the two stories I'm thinking about this week. That woman who I heard on the news, I watched on the news, describing the look in her neighbors, her friendly neighbors, remembering my Bubby's story in Germany. And the story of that girl in the Sabara's pizza shop and her father, who realized it's all one narrative. It's all one process. Because it's one process, have patience and perspective. Have confidence. Disregard all the noise and babble. Respond to it with faith. Don't be fatalistic. Don't be racist. Faith, confidence, disconnecting from social media and the anti-Israel sentiment, and patience. Shabbat Shalom.